The subject tonight is money management lessons from Second Tithe. I think people were shocked. A few asked me, well, what are you talking about tonight? And I said, money. Some of you from Indianapolis, I used to be laughed at when I was the pastor of Indianapolis. My fellow ministers would say, well, Vernon, what are you talking on today, money or sex? But they don't laugh anymore. Money management lessons from Second Tithe. So let's talk about money, specifically about money management. Money management. Money management is a very, very fascinating subject because it touches almost every aspect of life. Often the lament and cry from people is, we don't have enough money. We don't have enough money. There's not enough to cover our bills or expenses. Now, why would that be? How is it that they have less money than they have bills? As I said the other day, who held a gun to their head and made them get the bills? Well, it's necessities. We had to have it. But they don't have the money to pay for it. There's not enough to cover our expenses. Now, sometimes that is true. But sometimes it's not true. It is not true at all. Often it's a lack, emphasis on lack of management. We may not think about our family finances as needing to be managed, but they do. It seems at times, and I don't mean to be talking down anybody, Dale, at all, because I include myself in this, and I look back at my beginning years of learning to manage money, if indeed I have now, how ignorant I was. And it really was ignorance, and I suffered because of it. Many never think of managing money. They just think of making it and more specifically, spending it. Spending it. Love to spend money. The Bible is a book of God's laws and guidelines for spirituality and becoming like Him, so it might seem strange, but you'll find that God places a very high priority on how we handle our money. My mother used to say, the love of money is it's the root of all evil. Well, she didn't understand it was the lust for money. Now, lust is a little different than properly managing our money. God places a high priority on how we handle our money. And believe it or not, the Feast of Tabernacles offers an excellent vehicle for learning to manage money. You know it, but you may not have looked at it that way. It's called Second Tithe. Second Tithe, or as some people call it, Festival Tithe. It offers a very excellent opportunity for learning to manage money. 2T is really a wonderful opportunity if you're having difficulty in learning to manage money. Then year after year, when we come to the feast with our second tithe in our hand, as we are told to do in Deuteronomy, then we are learning how to manage our money and to cover all the bases year after year after year after year. So let's look in Deuteronomy 14, beginning in verse 22, and we'll see just a little bit about what God says about the management of money in connection with observing His feasts. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22 says, you shall truly, of a truth, tithe. That's an interesting word. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. You shall truly tithe. Right off the bat, you learn math. You learn math. In Luke 14:28, Jesus said, for those who want to follow Him And we as Christians want to follow Jesus. He said, it's like building a house. And he said, in order to build everything properly, you need to count the cost. Now, counting, accountants, they know how to count. They know how to handle money. They know how to manage money. And they have, as we were told today, I took all these and they balanced. They balanced, which is good news. In other words, he managed it and he did a very good job. So Jesus said we learn to count, or we should learn, and we should be willing to count the cost. What is this going to cost me? My wife gets frustrated sometimes when she says, I'd like to buy such and such. And I say, well, how much is it going to cost? What are we going to have to pay for this? Oh, well, we'll worry about that later. No, I'm making a little fun of my wife. She's a lovely lady, and she has manages money very, very well. We're told to learn to count the cost, and we're told to tithe of all that our field produces. But it didn't say how much. It just said tithe. Lee's stepfather was a very honorable gentleman, not a member of the Church of God, but he was telling me one time that he's tithed for years. He's now dead, but he tithed, and he gave 5%. And his church was thrilled to death to have him, because the others there didn't give that much at all, but he gave regularly 5%, and he called it tithing. Hold your finger here, we'll come back to this later, but in Leviticus 27 and verse 30, we will find a little bit that gives us understanding of what this is. All the tithe of the land, whether the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree, belongs to God, and it's holy to God. So we learn right off the bat that this tithe that we use for the feast and helps us learn to manage money is holy to God, and he calls it his money. He allows us to use it for a very special reason, and I don't think sometimes we realize what a wonderful reason it is, or how wonderful the reason is, and how much it can influence our family. Verse 32, concerning the tithe of the herd or flock, or whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to God. Tithe, tenth. One-tenth, it says we shall tithe all that our field produces, or one-tenth of the, ultimately the net value of the field or your business gives. It is a command of God, and it's a wonderful learning opportunity in life and helps us in managing money. In Malachi, God said, would a man rob God? None of us would think about going up to God while he was looking right at us for the pile of money right in front of God, just him and me, and you or me, and we would reach out while he was looking at us and take a hand of his money. Would we do that? No, but we would do it in other ways. I'm sure most of us have in certain ways. So we're told to tithe in Deuteronomy 14:22, you shall truly tithe all the increase. That's a very important word. If you're a businessman, I'm sure you understand that. If you're a farmer, you probably understand that. If you're a wage earner, you may not at first understand it, but the increase. Increase means the total income for the year from your corporation, your business, or your paycheck, minus all of the expenses that it took to produce that product. And we know, you know, you may bring in $500,000 in your company, but you certainly didn't make $500,000. It took you $400,000 to produce something. So you didn't make $500,000. You didn't increase $500,000. You increased $100,000. So we're told to tithe or give 10% of the increase that your field brings forth. Now that, of course, is talking about tithing in general. That would be the first tithe. We, of course, some would say, well, I have an inheritance, or I'm on welfare, or things like that. I hope we all understand we don't tithe on parental gifts or gifts. We don't tithe on inheritance. We don't tithe on welfare. We don't tithe the expense money that is given to us as a salesperson or a worker for another company. Those are expenses that are incurred in producing money for them. We tithe on the increase or what we make. Now, some have said, well, does that include taxes? We used to say, yes, it does. The church recently, I've forgotten how far back, decreed that it can, if you choose to, be after taxes, because taxes is not an expense, it's a theft of your money. We call it confiscatory, big word for taking it. And of course, once a nation has abandoned tithing, they have no other recourse other than taxation. And of course, taxation has quite often been a sliding scale according to how much you make. Our present president is talking about taxing the rich more than the poor. But the beautiful thing about tithing is it is 10% with no loopholes. And it doesn't matter if you make $1 billion and the other person only makes $10, we give 10% of our increase. Nothing could be more fair, just, and honest and honorable than tithing. In politics, I don't know that they got it from tithing, but they ask sometimes to have a flat tax. And that's never gone over at all. But tithing is a flat tax in the sense that it's 10% for everybody, whatever you make, 10%. No loopholes, no promises. You don't get any breaks because you brought a business in there. If you made it, then you owe God 10%. 10% of the increase. Right off the bat, we learn to figure math. We figure increase. We figure the total minus the expenses. And it is a very, very big lesson to learn. Jokingly, you may have heard, you know, the government tries to improve the tax principles every year. And you've heard of the recent one, haven't you? It's very, very simple. The government says, how much did you make? Send it in. That's easy. But the flat tax is a wonderful thing. Beginning in verse 23, you will find that there are quite a few principles here that follow on how to manage your money, and specifically of second tithe this time. And I said the lessons of money management, the title was the Money Management Lessons from Second Tithe. If we expand these principles found here to all of our income, then indeed second tithe is a microcosm of money management. And we can use these principles for all of our income. So beginning in verse 23, after explaining that we should tithe, you shall eat. Well, wait a minute, what do you mean eat? In Malachi, it said that the tithe belonged to God, and if you took it, you're stealing. And yet here it says, we shall eat the tithe. So obviously this has to be talking about an additional tithe, or as we call it, second tithe. You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe. Or in other words, if your tithe is greenbacks, you don't eat that, but it means that you use the tithe for whatever is needed to have food and other things at the place where God holds his feast. You shall eat the tithe of your grain. And very few are farmers anymore, but we have forgotten a lot of good things about the farm. Your new wine, the oil, the firstborn of your herds and flocks, so that you may learn to respect or fear or stand in awe because of his wonderful principles. So you'll find, beginning here, a lot of these principles about tithing. And if we expand on those, then we are learning how to manage all of our money. I hesitate to say that this has to do with budgeting, because many, if not most people, look on budgeting as a negative thing that is inhibiting us from enjoying life, or it prohibits us from having what we want. And so we look on budgeting as absolutely negative. So I call a budget a spending plan. That sounds better. A spending plan. And indeed it is. I mean, spending is not wrong. I mean, money was made to be spent. So you see, you learn to allocate. You learn to budget. You learn to use it for specifics. So beginning in verse 23, again, just a little, we are to eat the second tithe, or we are to use this second tithe when we go to the place where God puts his name for our livelihood. In those days, it was grain and new wine. Today, we buy our wine at Costco and bring it with us. Your herds and flocks, and so that you may learn to fear God. Let's notice in Ecclesiastes 10, verse 19, it says you are to eat these things. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 19, a little bit about money, because in verse 24, it said, if the journey is too long, this is still in Deuteronomy 14:24, if the journey is too long, you're not able to carry it. If the place where he chooses to put his name is too far away, and I drove 800 miles to get here, we carried some things in the car, but not everything that we would like to have. He said, then you shall exchange it for money, the animal that you had. You shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. You are to exchange it for money. Money is an inert, lifeless something. It has no life of its own. Some people say that money is evil. It's evil if you use it for evil purposes. It is absolutely marvelous, and sometimes beyond belief, what good money can bring to you when it is used properly. In Ecclesiastes 10, verse 19, you'll find this. A proverb, an explanation of money. Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 19. A feast is made for laughter. We're at a feast of temporary dwellings. I think sometimes we forget this, especially after travel a long way. You're tired when you get there. It is called a feast. It is to have a festive atmosphere. A feast is made for laughter. lifts your spirits. Wine makes merry. Now, you have to be careful sometimes. If you drink it on an empty stomach, it'll make you more than merry. If you drink it with a meal, then it'll be fine. Wine makes merry, but money answers everything. They say that money talks. And, of course, people use money to bribe others to get their way, and it talks in that way. For most of us, money says bye-bye. Money answers everything. I call money an exchange for life. What is life? It's food, it's clothes, it's experiences, it's a car, it's a home, it's many, many, many things. You go to a clothing store and you see this suit and it says $500. You look in your pocket, $50 is all you've got. So you don't get it. But if you had $500 and you were able to spend it, you give him $500 in bills and he gives you a really beautiful suit. So it is an exchange for life. And so God says we're to take the tithe, if it's produce or animals or things, exchange it for money and take that to the feast and use that for the things we need at the Feast of Tabernacles. It says we are to eat this tithe, which is 10%. How many families in this society spend 10% of their income on their family to build and develop the family, to give them experiences that they will always remember? Even many of our youth who have left still remember the many wonderful experiences they had at the feast. Many wonderful experiences that their father and mother spent their money so their children could enjoy that. So we spend 10% on our family and anybody else under the umbrella of our family that we want to. So there's a huge lesson here in the second tithe at the feast. Work hard all year, take a break, and spend 10% on your family and your friends. There is another big lesson, and that is, it says that we are to spend this on food and other things or priorities. One of the reasons that people do not have enough money for what they would like to have is because they don't have a priority list for spending their money. It's whatever pops up in front of them, and if they got the money, they'll spend it. It is known that if you take a credit card to the store with you, you'll probably buy more than you would if you had the amount of cash in your pocket. Because it's painless when you hand them a piece of plastic and they give you a suit. It doesn't make sense, humanly. So, priorities. Notice it is talking about essentials. Food, clothes, those things. Those are absolute essentials in life. And he's talking about the good essentials of life. Grain, wine, oil, firstlings of herds and flocks. The good things of life that we enjoy. The reason that we may not have enough is that we may not have the best of priorities in the spending of our money. We just react to whatever comes along. So one big lesson is spend the second tithe for our priorities that are good, wholesome, and add to life. Another one, which we read, corn, wine, oil, and firstlings, flocks, and herds, solid commodities. Solid commodities. The good things of life, not junk. Not junk. You go to a fair and cotton candy. Now, I'm not knocking cotton candy. I've had my share. But it's not the best of food. I would rather have a nice steak. and there are lots of them here at Jekyll, I suppose. Good food that are good for life. There is another huge lesson that is mentioned in this verse 23. It says we are to do this not because it makes God any bigger or we alleviate his anger, but we learn how good and how right are his principles and how much he's concerned about our experiencing those. There's an overall educational activity coming here. It says we are to learn to revere God, to learn that his ways are right, they're good and profitable. I don't know if you've ever heard the expression, but I've heard it said, and it struck me pretty deeply when I first heard it. You pay for education once, but you pay for ignorance continually. That hit me between the eyes. So we turn it into money, and we use it for the extremely important things as an exchange of life. Now, there is another big, big, big point that is listed here that is subliminal, and we don't even see it. Now, we're experiencing it, but we don't exactly get it just by perusing that point. It's unstated, it's kind of subliminal, but it's obvious that we, concerning this money, set it aside before we need it. We set it aside before we need it. You remember the old Christmas Club accounts at banks where you deposit a little money all year long so you'd have money for December 25? That way they were helping you to have money to spend at their stores and at bank. We save second tithe all year long rather than not saving it, then coming to the feast with no money but a big credit card and put it all on the credit card and then pay it all off the following year plus 15% interest. That is not God's way. His way is better, that we save it, we set it aside before we need it, and we're getting the most for our money. We're really being short-cheated and cheated when we pay the credit card and then over a period of a year pay that off. Have you ever looked at your, like an American Express card account, or they are now required to put on there, if you make only the minimum payment amount each month, how many months or years it will take you to pay that off? Recently, Lee and I went to, it was a trip for the church, but I paid on the credit card, put it on the credit card, and when I got it, I looked at it, and if I'd just paid the minimum of that charge for that month, it would have taken me 14 years to pay off that. Incredible. But we are set up to live on credit. We are targeted to live on credit. But this shows that we set it aside before we need it. A big, big, big lesson here. The habit, I emphasize habit, the habit of saving for a worthy goal for all. You may have read the statement that said the borrower is a slave to the lender. Debt is likened unto being in prison. In the book, The Richest Man in Babylon, it's a small book, I think about 100, 150 pages. It was a novel in a sense, but it had some wonderful principles about money management. These men had all grown up together. They went to the same school. They played in the same area. They knew each other. They were generally alike. None was ahead of the other. But after many years, one of them began to rise above them as far as wealth was concerned. They worked hard, but they never seemed to have enough to pay their bills. But here he was, and he had more than enough, and it seemed the more he gave away or spent, the more he had. And so they said, I think his name was Arkad. They said, well, let's go ask him. Why is it this way? You're no better than us. We played together. We're the same. We're all brothers, you might say. But you have far more money than we have, and we just don't know. What's your secret? And he said, well, now listen carefully, because if you don't, you'll think that I'm wasting your time. And he said, I found the key to wealth when I decided, emphasis on decided, when I decided that a part of all that I earn is mine to keep. And they looked at him and they said, is that all? Surely there's more secret to it than that. They said to him, well, all of what we have is ours. He said, no, it isn't. You make payments. And they said, yeah, we make payments and we don't have any left. They didn't know how to save. The key to his success was that he had the habit of saving. And when it came time, he could buy what he needed, and often you can buy at a discount if you hand them money. As they say, money talks. DeLee's good at that, at going to garage sales. Would you take? And the women are good. Would you be willing to take? Oh, yeah, I will. You pay cash, you get it a little better. I found the key to wealth when I decided that a part of all that I earn is mine to keep. The habit of saving. It is one of the sad things of the life in the USA that we have lost the ability, seemingly, to save. I'd like to read just a little bit from yesterday's USA Today magazine newspaper. I looked at the title and I couldn't believe it. Debtors are burying their heads in the sand. It was on the money section, Section B. The subtitle, more people are in trouble, but fewer are seeking help. Even as more Americans are piling on debt, because of the lagging economy, fewer are seeking counseling or other kinds of relief to try to get their finances back in order. Poverty has increased. Unemployment stubbornly hovers around 9%. Meanwhile, consumers, you and me, fellow Americans, accumulated an additional $18.4 billion in credit card debt in the second quarter. Multiply that by four, and you get $72 billion in credit card debt. People need help more than ever, but they are not coming to us, said a spokeslady for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. And then she said, and this is what struck me, I think some are just tired of trying and have given up. Well, they have never been taught. They are spending. They are buying on credit card, and they're paying 5 to 15% interest, and they can't seem to understand why life is not fair. The habit of saving before you need it. Saving in advance. You talk about tough love. Well, you know, life can be cruel, but it can be wonderful also if we discipline ourselves. Yeah, it's hard to save. And DeLee and I learned that, I won't say the hard way, in 98 when the United Church of God took a beating because of a split at that time, 29 of the ministers were put on a half salary and asked to find a job elsewhere. And of course, Delia and I were one of those 29 families. And I got out the budget and looked, and said, well, do we need this? Oh, yes, we need this. Can we give this up? Oh, no, we can't do that. But you know, I'm at the tail end of the Great Depression, and I remember some of the endings of that from 29 to 39. I was born in 36, and I hear stories from my sisters and my father and mother about the poverty that we had in those years. And the Great Depression taught people an awful lot that when you can't get it, what do? You do without. But today it is hard to do without because we are such a wealthy, or have been such a wealthy nation. But now as a nation we owe $14.5 trillion. They called it a stimulus. But the stimulus was to be the banks, to bail the banks out so they could lend money to us so that we could borrow so they could get interest. We are based on, our system is based on credit, not saving in advance and paying cash. If you have read Dave Ramsey's books, he says an awful lot about that, of saving and spending cash. I don't mean that it is wrong to have a credit card. I have quite a few credit cards, and I spend overall a lot of money every year, year after year, on credit card. But they don't get one penny of interest from Hargrove. We pay it off. It's how you manage it. It's how you use it. Coming to the feast should not be that we come here broke and spend our credit card, or we use our credit card, go home, and pay it all off at 10 to 15% interest. That is not how it's explained in the Bible. That's why I say we learn certain things of money management from Second Tithe. Second Tithe. It might be, one might think, well, you're cruel. Well, look at what God said. It doesn't mean it will last for life that way. When we learn to do it God's way, then life is wonderful. It is very, very enjoyable. Some talk of tithing as a burden. I've heard people tell me that, well, I had it better before I was in the Church of God than I do now in the Church of God. I believe them. But I don't think they understand some of the principles of managing money. So some talk of tithing as a burden. Maybe it is in a way, you know. Even a youth knows if you take 10% out of what you got 10% less than what you had. But if we use Second Tithe properly, maybe we can cover some of those bases where we do have need. I think in times past, we may have explained Second Tithe for feast things exclusively too hardly, that it should be on feast necessities only. And then, of course, when we did that, we didn't have any money left for other things, and so other things went begging. Other needs went begging. So I think the problem is maybe how we taught Second Tithe many years ago, not tithe itself. There are a few ways in which Second Tithe can alleviate, to a degree, the need for money in other areas. And I'll list several here that may help you in that respect. Because the feast is not to be a burden, something that we hate, and it is not to be a heavy, heavy, heavy something over our head. It is to be a feast, a wonderful time to really enjoy. First of all, many people would like to take a vacation, but if they go to the feast, then they don't have the money for both. Well, maybe we can plan a little bit, if it's possible, of a sort of a vacation with the family and use the second tithe for that. As I said, our children have many memories of the feast. And, when I was first in the ministry, we didn't take vacations. We were taught in those early years, you work till you die in your boots. and you didn't have time for a vacation. And it was, I don't know, sometime in the 60s, late 60s, Mr. Rod Meredith mentioned taking vacation for the ministers, Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And he said, well, I don't take vacations. And Rod Meredith said, that's true, Mr. Armstrong, but you take work breaks where you go away from the campus and away from the church and you spend time. Well, apparently that must have hit a nerve because after that, then we were given vacations. So I know what it's like not to have a vacation as a minister for years. So not that keeping the feast and having your second tithe will mean that you will never have a vacation, but we're talking about making the whole thing work. Make it a vacation if you can. If your automobile needs tires or a tune-up, or maybe if it's, what do they call them, clunkers, and you could take some second tithe with a down payment for an automobile, fine. Clothes, we need clothes. Maybe you could buy a suit for yourself and your sons, shirts, dresses, shoes, jackets. Wait till fall, till they're on sale, and then buy them out of second tithe for the Feast of Tabernacles, and then you can wear them the rest of the year. Cleaning before and after the feast, that saves money. Cleaning had really gone up. Cut down on entertainment and use it for clothes if your money is short. Gifts, if you have enough. Nice things for other people, one or two for the family. And then others, if you have money for that. I remember when we went to St. John's, Newfoundland, I believe that's where it was, and my wife happened to notice that an older lady sitting next to us didn't have a Bible. So she took some of the money that she had, our second tithe, went out and bought a Bible for the older lady, brought it back and gave it to her. And the lady was just absolutely thrilled. Food. We eat lots of food here. If you spend, well, I'll put it this way. If you left home and there wasn't any food in the fridge when you left and you come back and there still isn't, well, take some second tithe, go buy a bag of groceries out of that. This is the Feast of Sukkoth, or Booths, Tabernacles, Temporary Place. There's a lesson here. We use our second tithe to stay in the best, but it all means within our means. We're also looking forward to New Jerusalem when the streets are paved with gold. And New Jerusalem itself is an absolute eye-popper, which will be our home forever. But that doesn't mean we have to mimic it now and go deeply in debt to do it. We stay in the best we can afford, because it is a feast and pictures the kingdom of God. Charity, maybe you're not able to give charitably. If you have excess second tithe, then maybe you could help someone else just a little bit here. You know, that doesn't mean we're saying that you should take your hard-earned money and give it to someone who didn't earn theirs hard or didn't even save second tithe. That's a lesson they're going to have to learn. But to help in some small way. Then you will find, and I've mentioned it, but I would like to make a comment here in Deuteronomy 14, verse 26. You are, and this is a big lesson too in life, you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. Now, I didn't say lust after, but desire. For oxen, sheep, wine, similar drinks, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, you to eat before the Lord your God, and you shall, notice the word that is used, we sing this word, but I don't think we sometimes, because we hear another word so often that it blots this one out. It said, we shall rejoice. Rejoice means joy again. It seems this generation is taught that if you don't have fun, it's not worth doing. Fun, 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 fun. Did you know you cannot find the word fun in the Bible? Mm-mm. You can't find it in the Old King James or the New King James. It's not there. Does that mean then that God is this stern person that doesn't want you to have any fun in life at all? Just grind it out. No, not at all. It says, rejoice. And the second, you know, the fruits of God's Spirit, those qualities that are produced in us by having God's Holy Spirit, not just any old spirit, but the Holy Spirit is first of all love, thoughtfulness for people, and the next is joy. Not fun, but joy. Now, I'm not again fun, but I'm just saying the Bible uses the word rejoice, and joy is this deep inner satisfaction and contentment which is the result of knowing that you did the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And it lasts. It lasts and leaves very, very pleasant memories and feelings in our heart. Joy. And we go to the feast and we should rejoice. That is, come away with joy. Delia and I spent our 25th wedding anniversary. We married right after the feast in 62, so the feast and our anniversary interact sometimes. We were in Jordan, Israel, and Egypt for the feast. And in Cairo was our anniversary, I think, that night. Men are not all that good at remembering when the anniversary is, but it was close anyway. We were in this really beautiful former mansion, English mansion of one of the lords or principal rulers, and it was a motel, hotel, a bar or lounge, and we had something to drink. We went out on the little porch or veranda outside that, sat down, drank a glass of wine, enjoyed each other's company as we watched the Nile River gurgle by, and we looked out in the distance to the south, downtown Cairo, and thinking of all the poverty and the suffering that was there. There was joy in that event. I still remember it. To be with a lovely lady, 25 years, and it was in connection with God's truth. This experience was as a result of second tithe and observing the feast. It was some fun, yeah, but it was a lot of joy, and I still remember it. There's a pleasant something in me because of that. Rejoice. Make it fun if you can, but this is building a family. And it is a very huge lesson in using money to build a family, to build a life, and to learn principles that are absolutes that you can always have faith and confidence in. In Psalm 112, let's read this in connection with this point. Psalm 112, it starts off with praise the Lord, or thank God, honor God. Blessed is the man who fears or respects God, who delights greatly in his ways or commandments. Notice it says in verse 2, his descendants, children, grandchildren, in a case like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, his descendants will be mighty on earth. You ever think of that about yourself? Christians should be long-term thinkers. I was in Trader Joe's in Chicago one day years ago, and I was looking for some, I was just looking, but I happened to be in the area where the laundry detergents were, and I noticed seventh generation laundry detergent. And I picked it up, was looking at it, and I was stunned when I read the announcement that was on the box. It said, and this was the forgotten Indian tribe name, said, we should think, and I've forgotten the exact words, but the essence was, in every decision that we make, we should think to the seventh generation. I thought, wow. What a thought, that we need to be thinking seven generations ahead. Well, here it says, his descendants will be mighty on earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Then notice verse 3, wealth. Wealthy people are not evil. I've heard it said that wealth only makes you more of what you already were. You can think that through for a while. Wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness endures forever. Then down in verse 9, it says, he has dispersed abroad, he has given to the poor. His righteousness, that is, the good and right things that he did, will endure forever. Now, I won't read it, but if you read 2 Corinthians 9, verse 9, you'll find that the Apostle Paul ripped this right off the page and applied it to the New Testament church in Corinth. Had to do with making good decisions, using money properly, honoring God, respecting God, doing things God's ways. Took it right out of the Old Testament about families, parents, thinking of their descendants, giving to the poor, helping, managing their own life so that they're able to help others. Rejoice. You're building a family. You're looking to the future to be a part of a family. As I said, money management principles and lessons from the second tithe. Money is wonderful if we use it properly. It adds immensely to life. And once you begin managing it, you can't believe the change that comes about for the good, because you're able to do for yourself, your wife, your children, and others as you're able to do. I was talking to a wealthy man recently, and I mentioned to him, I said, I know you're wealthy, and I know you're able to spend money for lots of things. He said, I know, but he said, I have never flaunted it. And I realized, that's right, he doesn't. He never flaunts his wealth, but he is wealthy, and he helps. I don't know how much he's helped, but I know he does. And it's good. People are helped because he worked hard. There was a time when he just had a job. I remember he was telling me one time he had a job, and someone else said, well, if you go over to this place, you can get a job that pays more money. He said, I don't need that. I've got a job. He was just happy. He was happy, hardworking man, and he just kept working hard and then went into a business, and now he's a multiple millionaire. Because he managed himself and he managed his money. And he's helped an awful lot. Some might say after hearing what I said tonight, well, I'll need $1 million to do all that you're talking about. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. Remember, we're talking about managing. Managing. And priorities. And within your means, gradually living and doing better. The marvelous part of this saving and using, that is managing, second tithe, it's for the good of all. And it can be applied to the rest of all that we do. I would like to read just one other particular thing. Well, maybe two, but it won't take long. In Exodus 21, and verse 1, a very strange statement is made. Exodus 21, these are the judgments or decisions which you shall set before Israel. And here comes this strange one. If you, an Israelite, if you buy a Hebrew servant or slave, who in the world would buy his brother? Now, I hasten to add here, this is not talking about slavery that we knew hundreds of years ago in the USA that led to a horrible war. This is not talking about white buying black. This is talking about white buying white, your own brother, your own relative. He will serve him 6 years, and in the seventh he'll go out free and pay nothing. Why in the world would you have to buy your brother? Well, if you keep reading, you'll find that the parents even had to sell their child. Poverty. Lack of money or lack of managing money. That's an awful thing. But God gave a law to prevent that. You've heard the statement that a nation is no stronger than its weakest link. Weakest link. Yes, weakest link. This is talking about taking over the, I suppose, decisions of a person, a man, who just never learned to handle money. And it's called mentoring. The problem is today we can't do that, and most would not allow it because it would hurt their ego too much to admit publicly, I don't know how to handle my pocketbook. God did not want them to suffer forever. 6 years, that's not long. And if you don't learn it in 6 years, well, I guess you can do it again. But it's a wonderful law God had, mentoring, teaching, showing how to use money. Well, God does it with us in the second tithe at the feast, learning how to do that. This law is a fundamental reason why the entire nation of Israel would have been financially sound and stable if they had followed that. It was not slave trading. It was a law to prevent or to repair debt and poverty. Then there is one other In Matthew 25 and Luke 19, you know the story. Excuse me. You know the story of the talents and the pounds. In the New King James, they're called minas. But in the Old King James, talents and pounds. Ability, if you want to call it a talent, like a human talent, yes. But both of these are a unit or measure of money. In both places, God uses money as a type of Christian growth and character development, which leads to rulership in the kingdom of God. How could that be? Well, the same principles are involved in both cases. To develop Christian character, one must be in control of one's life. One of the fruits of God's Spirit is self-control, the ninth one, or discipline. To manage money properly, one must be in control of one's pocketbook. You may have heard the statement, if you're not in control of your own life, then you'll have to yield to someone who's in control of their life. That's a hard statement, but it's a living law. The more we try to succeed in both areas, the more we will see the connection. You may reread those sometime and see the connection that talents, pounds, monetary measures, and yet they're talking about Christian growth and rulership in the family of God, the kingdom of God forever. One of them who didn't produce and said God was unfair is like the person today. When he hears the word budget, says, nobody is going to tell me how to manage my money. And that's true. Nobody will be able to. We have to finally buy into that and begin to do it. And then we'll see how wonderful life is. And afterward, a little smile comes on the face. I remember we lived in Hammond, Indiana, some years ago, and I went to the post office one day, and there was a lady there, saddest face I'd ever seen, who was working behind the counter. I bought some stamps, and I gave her the money, and I said, thank you, when she handed it to me. Totally bland face. So I went back the next time, whatever I bought, same thing. And I said to myself, I want to take this lady on as a test case. She's going to smile. So I kept going back, ordering whatever I ordered. When she handed me what I ordered, I would smile and say thank you. One day, after quite a few times, I saw this. Her lip went just a little bit up. She tried to stop it, but she couldn't. And the next time I said thank you, she smiled. Well, we moved away from there to Crown Point, Indiana, south a few miles. And one day I had to go back to that post office and I bought something. And I said, I know you. She said, yeah, I remember you too. And she smiled. The reason she was so unsmiling, I'm sure, was she had had a very hard, difficult, horrible life. Life was unfair, but she learned to smile. We're supposed to be representatives of God's truth. And so when we begin to live God's ways in the handling of our money, we can be pleasant to people. We know they are having a hard time. They are having a hard time, but they're having it because they haven't yet bought in to those principles which are absolutes. And when they do, a smile will come on their face when they will see the good results. Jesus said, count the cost. We may say, well, how much is it going to cost me? You have to ask, How much do I have to pay? Second tithe is an opportunity each year to hone our skills in learning to count the cost. So, I urge you to give yourself to managing your money properly. I'm not saying you're not. I'm just saying that as a general statement, because we all could learn a little better to manage what we have. It's amazing. People want to be financially stable, but they don't study how. People want to have a good marriage, but they don't study how. People want to be good parents, but they don't study how. There are plenty of books on how to manage money. There are plenty of books. You can go to the library and get them free, or you can buy them and have them as a reference material. There are quite a few. Dave Ramsey is one. Susie Orman is another. I learned from Charles Gibbons many years ago in Florida. There are many that teach. They make lots of money. Lots of money teaching people how to manage their money, where God gives it free of charge, and it's a part of becoming like Him. So I would urge us all, including myself, to learn more and more about managing our money, because it is an exchange of life. You'll learn more about life, and you, your family, and your grandchildren, and your future generations will greatly profit, and your life will change in a dramatic way that you never dreamed could be possible.